by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour, Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls, Henry Frain. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about stem cells and their promise for medicine. Our guest for the program will be Ann Parson. She's a science journalist and has a new book out on this topic, which is titled The Proteus Effect. On the program Thursday, we will talk a little bit about the recent elections that took place in Afghanistan and what is going on in that country. The guest there is David Edwards. He's professor of anthropology at Williams College. Also on Thursday, we'll talk about Britain and British politics and Tony Blair. And there, our guest will be James Naughtie. He's lead anchor of BBC Radio 4's Today Show, former chief political correspondent of The Guardian, and has authored a recently published book, which is titled The Accidental American, Tony Blair and the President. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. 10 different topics for you every week, and always welcome your questions and comments. Well, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about American politics. And our guest for the show is Scott Althaus. He is associate professor of both speech communication and political science, and among other things, is interested in news and how it is put together, how the news media report on politics, how politicians try to get their messages across to the populace, how the avenues for people for that to go the other way, that is, how it is the politicians try to figure out what people think should happen and how that gets communicated, how campaigns are covered, how the nature of campaigning has changed. All these things are things that he's thought about and written about, and we'll try to dip into some of these subject areas this morning. Also, of course, people who are listening, if you have questions, they're welcome, and I know he'll take his best shot. If he feels it falls within his area of interest, he has something to say, he will do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
One of the things that I know that you're interested in is generally how closely people pay attention to the news and current affairs. And you would think that at a time like this, when we have a presidential election going, that would likely go up. And one might actually think, given what's been going on here the last couple of years, ever since September 11th, that people would be really interested in international affairs, in the war on terror, and the war in Iraq, all those sorts of things would lead people to pay more attention maybe than if all those things weren't going on. And I guess I wonder about that. How does the amount of time people spend paying attention to the news go up and down in relation to things that are happening, particularly things that seem to be really important, like wars and presidential elections?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And the context here that's important to keep in mind is that over the last 30 years, we've seen declines in viewership of network television news, in readership of newspapers, some rise in listening to radio news, but declines generally across the board. So if attention to the news has been going down over time, you would think that there's room for people to pick the news back up as a habit when times change and events make paying attention to what's going on in the world a much more important and interesting thing to do. But it turns out that when you look at Nielsen ratings over time for television or newspaper circulation information, that 9/11 did provide a bit of a bump in terms of immediately doubling the size of the news audience for network television news from about 13% of American adults in the week before 9/11 to about 26% during the week of 9/11. But what's interesting is that the week following that, immediately the news audience snaps back down to about 15% of American adults and really doesn't deviate from that more than a percent or two from then until now. Hmm.
Was that really so different? Say, look at the 1950s or back, you know, however far back we've got data so that we could answer a question like that. Were people in previous generations more interested in the news? Did they try better to keep up?
It's hard to tell, and it's hard to tell because of the changing nature of the news media over time. Back in the early part of the 20th century, newspapers were the only game around, really, if you wanted to find out what was going on, and newspaper readership was extremely high. On average, during the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, the average household in the United States subscribed to about 1.5 newspapers. Today, it's less than half a newspaper per household, so it's every other household subscribes to a newspaper. But what makes it challenging to say, well, people were more or less attentive then than now, is that first we had radio come on the scene, which stole some of the audience away from newspapers, and then television came in the 40s and 50s and stole audience away from radio, and then we had cable and the internet and satellite. And so today we have a much more fragmented news audience, and it becomes more difficult to tell whether these overall declines in the traditional sources of news, newspapers, broadcast television, signal a lowering of the overall amount of attention to the news, or just that we've got people divided up among a broader range of news choices.
Yeah. Well, that gets into some interesting questions about what are sometimes called new media and how they compete with traditional media and who is interested in them. Does that break down according to age? I mean, is it the case that younger people tend to be more attracted to something like the internet and older people to a more traditional form of news like the newspaper or possibly broadcast? And whether those things, whether having more places to get information gets more people interested in getting the information, or we've got a sort of a finite pool of people who are hungry for news and that they're going to go wherever the news is. But it's the same group of people. It's not that group has gotten larger. It's just that their world of choice has gotten larger.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we look at just the news offerings that we have today compared to 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, I think we'd have to say that people's interests in particular kinds of news are better satisfied today. No longer is it the case that you have to go through one newspaper, your local newspaper, and scan through every page to find just the particular articles that you're interested in. Today you can go to a website that is all about the topic that you care about, or to filter the information that's coming to you by setting up preference options at something like News at Yahoo or other agents that allow you electronically to receive only the kinds of news that you're interested in today. So it's much easier to fit my particular interests with particular news sources that I'd like to get it from today than was the case before. That seems to be a good thing, but the broader picture is more complicated because not only do we have an increasing diversity of news sources that cater to different kinds of people. Young people read certain kinds of newspapers. Older people follow the news from different places. But we also have a broadening out of entertainment choices, too. Mm-hmm. And so the more options that we have, the more distractions that we have. And it turns out that some studies have shown the growth of cable television in particular has attracted a sort of mushy middle audience, that they would pay attention to the evening news or to presidential debates or things like that if they didn't have any other choice because they're planning to sit down and watch TV at a particular time. But given the choice to watch something that is more entertaining relatively, a sizable portion of that audience will shift out to follow entertainment. And that then creates a net decline in audiences for many of these news outlets.
Yeah. There has been a fair amount of ink spilled over time about young people and how engaged they are, how well informed they are, what do they know about history, what do they know about current politics? Maybe that's the kind of thing that's always the older generations have always despaired the younger generations and they're being out of touch. But, you know, having said that, is there a big difference in news interest and news consumption between, say, people over 50 and people under 25, either in their interest in their seeking out of news or in where it is they go to get their news.
Yes, and this has been a big concern of the newspaper industry in particular, but also of broadcast television, because if you look at the demographic profile of the typical viewer of a nightly network news program, that typical viewer is going to be in their middle 50s in terms of age breakdown. And if we look at that over time, we'll see that the age of that average viewer has been growing older and older as time has progressed. And so younger viewers are going elsewhere. They're either turning off the news and listening to something else, or they're going to other news options. And some studies have shown that younger people are more attracted to the internet and online sources of news, which makes sense. They're, overall, the amount of internet activity and use is higher among younger people than older people. But it's also the case that younger people are withdrawing from other traditional news outlets like newspapers. And why this causes such concern for the newspaper industry and the television industry in particular is the finding that paying attention to the news is kind of a habit. It's like having your cup of coffee in the morning. It's something you look forward to. It's something you do on a regular basis. And when you get out of the habit of picking up a newspaper or watching a news broadcast on TV or listening to one on radio, it becomes very difficult to pick that habit back up. And that's what I've seen in some of my research, where we have a sudden change of context. First, the United States is at peace, and now we're at war. Does that bring people back into the news audience? And aside from these short-term effects, my studies have found that they really have not had that kind of an influence, that the news audience is still very habitually small for the traditional news outlets, regardless of what happens to be going on in the larger world. But the one difference seems to be the election campaign today. More and more people are paying attention to the campaign than has been the case in recent years. And just to give you one statistic, the vice presidential debate, which is not typically the pinnacle of the fall campaign, attracted a larger audience in this election campaign than the initial presidential debate in the 2000 election. So people are very attentive today in ways that they have not been, and that is particularly so among younger people, 25 to 18, basically, are much more attentive today than they typically are in the context of presidential campaigns.
Yeah. How do we explain that, or is there a way to explain that?
Well, it is really hard to tell. We live in a different world in 2004 than we did in 2000, and so I think many of the things that political scientists took for granted in terms of what are the factors that drive attention to the news and voting for the presidency may no longer hold today, because we are in such a different environment. For the first time in the generation that is just coming of age to be able to vote or has recently come of age, there is a major military crisis going on around the world that involves our country. We'd have to go all the way back to the Vietnam era to find a similar parallel, because the wars since then have been relatively brief and have been more limited in duration and scope.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Scott Althaus. He's associate professor in both speech communication and political science here at University of Illinois. We're talking about some of the things that he's particularly interested in, news media, how people use it, who's using it, how various kinds of news is reported, public opinion, and how it helps to shape the news and how people in government track it. Now, all those questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to go back to for a second to the maybe the changing nature of media, or the fact that particularly we have a breakdown according to age of what you think of to be your news source. The traditional news outlets, big newspapers and news magazines and over-the-air broadcasters have recognized the importance, at least to some extent, the importance of the internet. And they have an internet presence. You can go down to the newsstand and you can buy the New York Times, or you can go to the web and you can read the New York Times. Is it the case, though, that people who are interested in the internet and sort of familiar with it, are they reading the New York Times on the net, or would those people, are they not interested in the New York Times? And it doesn't matter what form it comes in. They just think, well, New York Times, old media, they're looking for something else. And that the people who might look at the New York Times on the web are the same people that would read the print edition. I mean, how do you break that down according to the source and the medium?
Well, it's very interesting to speculate about this. The hard evidence on one side or another is hard to come by. But we have a news system in traditional media that is pretty highly concentrated, particularly in the newspaper industry. If you think, well, what's a national newspaper I'd like to read? It'd be the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, perhaps. And many people think that when we translate those news sources out into the internet and we provide a much broader range of choices, that people are going to make broader choices and they're going to spread themselves out pretty thinly. But it turns out that the amount of internet traffic to news sites, to internet sites that are devoted to providing daily news, is actually more concentrated online than it is offline in terms of newspaper subscriptions and so on. And so the big sources of information on the net are USA Today and the New York Times online and CNN. And once you go beyond the top five or six traditional sites, I include cable in the traditional mix, are people turning into new news sources that do not exist outside of the internet? Well, they are, but it's a small number of people that are doing that. Most of us go to what is familiar to us, and that is one of the challenges of the internet. We have now a lot of alternatives and options, but we don't know what's out there, and we want to make sure that we have a credible source of information and not just believe everything that we've heard on the internet. And that is another factor that attracts people to the online versions of these offline news sites.
Yeah, okay. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's start. We have someone in Indiana, toll-free line, line four.
Hello. Yeah. I hope this is apropos in some extent. I live in a small town east of Purdue University and subscribed to the paper, you know, from the beginning of time, more or less. Then it went through a couple of buyers. Then the last buyer that took it over has, I think, four or five newspapers in Indiana that that they own. And essentially, they, from looking at a town close to me, which is a little bit larger industrial town, it's pretty much the same state and U.S. news in terms of what they're, the columns and stuff. Then the difference is, you know, in terms of the local thing. I finally gave up on my local paper because I'd be reading an article and all of a sudden the damn thing just stopped, you know, in the middle of a sentence. And I thought, well, you know, somebody's messed up on the linotype or whatever, and it started happening. I finally called the newspaper and found out, and I was told that, well, unfortunately, our advertising space is more important. This is what it came down to. And the computer, you know, fits the things in, and if they don't fit, it takes out the news instead of the advertising space. And that seemed pretty crazy to me. And then I got a hold of New York Times, and I found out really what the heck they do in terms of a story, you know, from AP or something like that, how they pick and pull, which didn't bother me. But a lot of times what they took out was sort of, you know, the punchline or would give a particular aspect to the thing. So I gave up, and I just buy it ever so often now, usually like on a Sunday and a Monday, because I found out how they do the city news and where they put all the pamphlets in the Sunday paper, and then the Monday paper usually picks up the rest after that. One time, the New York Times was on Yahoo, and they got out of it, and they have the Washington Post now. So I use that quite a bit, but I just sort of wonder if small towns, if they're doing this thing of pulling, you know, certain paragraphs and lines out and not finishing a sentence, are sort of shooting themselves in the foot. And then the second question, which is way far afield, is that listening to NPR a couple days ago, I found out that the journalists, you know, are basically sitting in a in the green zone, being concerned about hit by rockets and trying to get their information from people out in the field, like I guess they do here in the United States too, to get information, and they don't have the slightest idea who the hell they're talking to, and that there's some areas of Iraq that there's nothing coming out, even though that there's bombings going on and car bombs, the suicide thing, but nobody knows anything about it until a long time afterwards, until somebody comes from that city to another place, that there's large areas of Iraq that essentially, you know, there's no news coming out at all, so nobody knows what's going on. How that fits into today's discussion, I hope somehow. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Well, actually, all of those things fit in today's discussion in some interesting ways, because the sorts of trends that the caller is talking about in part have to do with the changing economics of the news business. So we have local papers today that are offering fewer pages of news than they would have been able to 4 or 5 years ago. That has to do with the state of the national economy. Advertising in newspapers and on television is highly sensitive to the overall state of the economy. And a certain percentage of the newspaper space has to be devoted to ads in order to pay for bringing the news out in the rest of the paper. And so we've seen over the last few years the amount of news that can be reported in a daily paper has gone down because there's not as much advertising available to support that. So that may be one factor that's influencing the dynamics of this caller's local newspaper. But it's also the case that the newspaper industry in particular has been trying to respond to this overall drop-off in newspaper reading, and they've tried desperately to figure out, well, who is reading and why aren't other people reading? And increasingly, they're becoming sensitive to try to target particular demographics of audiences that they feel are the marginal audience. That is, they are not deeply committed to reading the newspaper. They might go somewhere else. There's another group of people, the sort of core newspaper audience, who is going to read the newspaper no matter what because it offers a sort of depth and insight that's not available in other news sources. Unfortunately, those readers often get taken for granted, and the news comes to focus on the topics and issues and the style of coverage that these marginal readers are more attuned to in an effort to bring them on board and hold on to them. The third pattern that the caller was talking about in Iraq in terms of the location of journalists over there, this is also partly a consequence of how expensive it is to have a reporter stationed overseas, not just in Iraq, but anywhere else. And if we live in an age when news audiences are declining, which means that news outlets can charge less and less for advertising and the amount of space or time that they have to give it, that means they can afford fewer and fewer reporters to be out there on the field. And one of the hopes of the news industry was that in a time of crisis, as we found ourselves after 9/11 and then with the Iraq War in 2003 and on, that more people would bring themselves back into the news audience so that these news organizations could provide the quality of coverage that they really want to provide. But now, in a variety of complex ways, are unable to, and partly because the ownership has changed of the news business over time, and partly it's just hard to get advertisers in the way that was easier when the economy was better.
Yeah. We have someone on a cell phone. They are next in line. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have sort of a question for you, but perhaps a little sense of perspective. I am a mother of young children. I was living in New York City at the time of the attacks, recently moved to this region, and found that I had to remove almost all media from my home in order to be protective of my young readers. And I didn't want to be forced to answer questions that I felt I really couldn't because they were not age appropriate. And since then, I've found that it, as a whole, our home has become sort of a haven, a safe place. And I have to go outside primarily to the internet to find my news after the children are asleep, just to maintain that sense of safety. So I guess that's just my perspective, and I'll hang up now and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a difficult challenge that parents face as to whether to encourage their children to watch or read the news or not, particularly with the nature of events that are being covered today. But if you looked at newspapers in particular or television news of, say, 30 or 40 years ago, while there were lots of crises going on in the world and some disturbing coverage in general, you would find news content that was probably would be of less concern to this caller. Stories were reported in somewhat different ways. We have shifted in our style of journalism today in the United States to emphasize a bit more of the drama in stories. There's always been drama in the news. You go all the way back to the colonial press, there's drama in the news. But particularly today, in this era where people are very concerned in the business about retaining that marginal viewer, that marginal reader, the news tends to be made a little bit more entertaining to hold on to them. And we see that sometimes in coverage of violence that we wouldn't see on TV in previous years. We also see on the flip side of coverage of trivial things that we might not have seen as much in previous generations. The squirrel on water skis that shows up on the local news is a staple today because it's entertaining and interesting, but not because it's important.
Yeah. Just one of the big criticisms that was made of the news media in the wake of 9/11 was the fact that they had cut back on international news coverage. And so a lot of people were saying, you know, we don't have the context to try to understand what goes on elsewhere and that event in particular. And I think the news media, for their part, said a couple of things. One thing that they said was, well, the reason we cut back on that is because the news consumer told us you really weren't interested, either directly or indirectly. And then also there is the economic issue. As you say, over time it's gotten more expensive to do that kind of reporting. Frankly, you know, now news organizations are expected, their news divisions, news organizations are owned by big companies, and their news divisions are now expected to make money, which in the days of when Uncle Walter was there doing the CBS Evening News, CBS Evening News was kind of a loss leader. It really wasn't expected to make money for the network. That's all changed. So all that stuff all goes together. And one of the things that news organizations did to try to trim their budgets was, well, they cut back on international coverage. And now all that being said, also acknowledging that since September 11th, international coverage, it seems, has become more important, have news organizations turned around and put more resources into their international coverage? And are people saying that they want that more? Are they, and then are they actually paying attention to it?
Immediately after 9/11 and with the beginning of the Iraq campaign in 2003, it was certainly the case that the news organizations, the corporations that own the major news outlets, put a lot of resources into international news and were actually taking a loss on the revenue flow that was coming back from that, but they felt that it was important to invest in that. There was a lot of interest in seeing that kind of coverage. But unfortunately, that becomes difficult to sustain over long periods of time. And so we've seen since the close of the sort of invasion part of the Iraq campaign, a lowering of the number of journalists who were stationed overseas. But there's also a different model of international coverage that's come to the forefront today. It used to be the case that CBS or NBC or the New York Times would feel that it had to station all of its own reporters all around the world, and they'd have bureaus in various continents and so on. Today, that's not seen as a terribly cost-efficient model, and what we're seeing is more use of in-country news sources who package some video and other news stories and send that over to the United States. So there's more of a network of associated news organizations today than there used to be in the past. And there may be some benefits that come out of that as well, because it's more likely the case today that you have indigenous reporters in these countries that are doing the primary reporting and able to get a sense of things that an American reporter, you know, basically parachuting into a conflict zone might not be able to pick up in short order.
Yeah. Well, there are people who will track news interest. That is, the organization like the Pew people, where they go out there and periodically they ask people, what stories are you most interested in spending most time following? And they put out long lists of these things just to, as an indication of, you know, how many people are really seeking out news and interested in the economy? How many are interested in news about education? How many people are interested in news about the war on terror? You know, those sorts of things. Has there been a substantial, I mean, and overall, you know, talked about the fact that right after September 11th, there was a jump up. People were really interested. And then about a week later, it sort of went back to what it had been before. Overall, though, has there been any sort of increase in interest in international affairs and that kind of reporting?
In this day and age, it's hard to separate a general interest in international affairs from the particular kinds of things that the United States is involved with in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. And those stories are very interesting to a lot of news viewers and readers. But if you look at the Pew News Index over time, the big stories that jump up to the top of that list are major disasters of natural or man-made variety, wars and things like that. International events, by and large, do not rise very high on the average part of that scale. So it has been the case in part because the news organizations have used more sophisticated marketing strategies to try to find out what it is that people are interested in today, that they think they have a better sense that people are not all that interested in international news, but are more interested in crime and the economy and personal finances and things like that. And so we see things like the Wall Street Journal having a weekend section now, and we see the New York Times going to four-color photos instead of just black and white as a way to meet what seemed to be some changing or new demands on the part of news consumers. But I think the case is out in some ways, whether in fact the news organizations have it right, because we certainly have seen the growth of independent news outlets. We see The Guardian, which is a major paper in the United Kingdom that tends to be on the left side of the political spectrum, now opening up media possibilities in the United States, because during the active part of the Iraq campaign, so much of its internet traffic came from the United States, mm-hmm. from readers and viewers who were frustrated with the kind of reporting that they were getting domestically and wanted to reach out to an international source.
We have some callers here. Again, we'll get right to them. And again, I should introduce again our guest, Scott Althaus. He's Associate Professor of Speech Communication and Political Science here at University of Illinois. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up, Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Hi. I was going to ask about Vietnam, but considering what you were just speaking out, I do have a few comments on that. So one example, I think, of relying on a stringer is NPR's British correspondent in Afghanistan, who I think is doing an extremely lousy job of reporting the election impasse. And I don't think the New York Times is doing much better, actually. They aren't looking at Human Rights Watch report called The Role of the Gun, which undermines the whole plausibility of an election going on right there. But that's not what I called about. I think the professor has actually did a study, sort of a content analysis of Vietnam coverage through the years, and I believe, if I'm not confused, he gave this talk at the Friday Forum. Is that correct?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you had some sort of you were sort of. I'd like for you to review that a little bit. I know it's hard to do in a short call-in, but the idea that there are misconceptions about how the coverage went. I mean, the right wing says the media lost Vietnam because one of their big examples is after the Tet Offensive, even though they say, the right wing says, we killed more Viet Cong than, you know, we lost or something like that, that was a successful battle. But the real thing to report, which I don't think even gets reported much or comment much now, was that for the Viet Cong or whoever, for the opposition to mount that kind of offensive right in the capital city of Saigon, exposed the fact that they had collaboration and acquiescence through the entire population, or they wouldn't have been able to pull it off. And the after-action report, which I think I cited a while back, sort of an after-action report on Vietnam, showed that 30% of the government in Saigon, our puppet government, was actually sympathetic to the U.S. getting out and a unification. So I'd like for you to say something about that. But the other point is, since you did a lot of this surveying of the media, and you probably looked at other people who were doing it, I wonder if anybody has surveyed sort of the ongoing drumbeat of lies that were propagated by the U.S. government during Vietnam, whether it's the body count or whether, you know, the original conception of Vietnam or the escalation under Johnson was a lie in the Gulf of Tonkin. That was a big lie. Another thing that's not commented upon that is that, you know, this was supposed to be an attack on U.S. boats, but what isn't commonly reported is that U.S. boats were going up along that north coast dropping special forces in for the longest time before that. So there was actually, not only was it not a sort of ambush. There was an untold front on the war that actually isn't commented on much. So there's a lot there, and I'll hang up probably and listen. But maybe I'll, if there's not too many people waiting, maybe I'll hang around.
Well, we do. I do have two other people who are in line.
Bye.
Okay. Well, thanks for the questions. You can go ahead and do what you like with those.
Sure. The Vietnam era is fascinating in the context of changes in the media on a number of fronts. But I think the one that the caller is referring to is the one I've done a little bit of research about and following up on, is the widely held belief that the reason we lost the war in Vietnam was because the media turned against it and pulled public opinion away from supporting the war. And this is an idea that if you ask people in Washington or on the street, this is a pretty widely held belief. But it turns out that there is some evidence that comes to bear on this, but it's not widely known. Studies that have gone back and looked at, news coverage in the Vietnam War investigated whether, in fact, coverage focused as much on casualties inflicted by and inflicted on Americans and atrocities and so on as people seem to think. We seem to remember that. We remember Vietnam. We remember My Lai. We might remember the famous Cam Ne story in 1965 when Morley Safer first showed American Marines lighting up the thatched roofs of the houses of Vietnamese civilians. But studies since have shown that that was not typical, and that was actually a pretty rare occurrence to see something like that on television news during the Vietnam era. Really, a lot of the coverage during that time was more showing maps and our troops are here and the battle's taking place over here and not really focusing so much on the personal side of the war. The other thing that we tend to think about with the Vietnam War is the idea that coverage became more negative over time, particularly after the Tet Offensive in January of 1968. And the caller was referring to this. This was the moment when Walter Cronkite came on national television and basically said, you know, we're losing the war. And it was widely thought that this precipitated a chain of events that drew public opinion away from supporting the war. But studies have shown that, to the contrary, while there was a shift pre and post Tet, news coverage did become relatively less positive about the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. It wasn't that the news coverage became lopsidedly negative. It was that before Tet, the coverage had been lopsidedly positive in favoring U.S. intervention, and after Tet, it became more balanced. So there was a relative shift to become less positive, but it was to become more balanced than it was before Tet. And what's interesting, and if you look at the trends for support in public opinion polls of the Vietnam War over time, there's no evidence at all that there was a radical change in support for the Vietnam War after Tet. The pattern is in late 1965, registers about the highest level of support for the war, in the middle 60% of Americans saying that they supported the war. And then regularly all the way through the end of 1971, dribbling away of support. There's no big peaks, there's no big troughs, there's just regular erosion of support over time, and that is not associated with these changes in news coverage. And I've been able to do some more detailed analysis on the case of the 1991 Persian Gulf War, and where I was able to measure both what was going on in broadcast news coverage of the war and what was going on in public opinion surveys showing support for the war. And what's interesting is that immediately after the August 2nd, 1990 invasion of Kuwait by Iraqi forces, up until the start of the November elections of that year, this was a period where the American administration under the first President Bush had pretty much free rein in terms of describing why it saw this Iraqi invasion as a threat to the United States and what it was going to do about it. It was a period where the media were highly dependent on administration sources to tell people what was going on over there. And news coverage, as a consequence, was uniformly positive over this several months. But what's interesting is that the support of President Bush's handling of the Iraq crisis began dribbling away right from the start. In a period where news coverage was very positive, support eroded away. And so that by the time those elections came about in the first week of November, support had flatlined. That ushered in at about 50%. That ushered in a period where there was a lot of debate in Congress about whether we should go to war that culminated in the air war. And over this time where suddenly there was a real intense division of opinion that was appearing in the news, support nor opposition changed much in American public opinion. It's pretty much a flatline until after the air war began. And immediately, when the air war began, I mean immediately, within 2 hours after it was reported out to American audiences on the night of January 16th of 1991, CBS News polling showed that support jumped right up to about 80%. And it didn't have anything to do with what the news was saying, because the news wasn't saying much at that point. But it had to do with the change in consequences. And I think what these patterns from Vietnam to the Gulf War and to the present suggest is that there isn't a simple relationship between whether news is relatively negative of, in our present case, Iraq, or relatively positive, and whether the public, the American public, is going to support that war effort or oppose it. The relationships are much more complicated, and in fact, the obvious conclusion to draw from the patterns that I've talked about is that there's no clear relationship between more positive news coverage, more positive support for the war.
See, that's very interesting because I was sitting here and listening, I was formulating some question about some ultimate question about, well, does that mean that we exaggerate the importance of the media and its ability to influence public opinion? But I'm not sure that that's really it's not as easy as that. Maybe the fact is, well, it's much more subtle. There's not a one-to-one sort of relationship. And that, yes, it's true that media coverage of these things does shape, it can't help but shape the way people think. But you have to be very careful in drawing straight lines, I guess,
that's
between
right.
the media coverage and then what people end up thinking.
That's right. And when media coverage is going to be most influential in shaping how people think is right at the beginning of a crisis or an event where people are first paying attention to a thing, but they don't have a lot of information about it. And the initial information that is supplied through the media can be very important for anchoring people's opinions and attitudes in a way that becomes very difficult to move them later on down the road. And to give you an example from the current presidential campaign, when John Kerry first won the nomination, or well, before the Democratic convention, but when it was obvious in the primary season that he had taken the nomination, immediately the Bush-Cheney campaign began doing a number of advertisements all around the country to suggest that John Kerry was a waffler on issues and that he couldn't be trusted to hold a steady line when it came to commitments on various policy proposals. And the strategic rationale for doing this came from a very good understanding of media effects. That is, you aren't going to influence people's attitudes one way or another once they've developed them about somebody like Kerry or so on. And that's why we're seeing a pretty much a flat line in terms of the ballot test questions, who you're going to vote for on election day between Bush and Kerry right now. But when people are first sizing up a candidate and they don't know much about that candidate, it's an opportunity for the media to have an impact. And I think we see today the staying power of this charge that Kerry is a wishwasher may come directly from this big ad buy in part that was raising this issue to the attention of Americans around the country. But, you know, there's also something in his record that is part of the grist for this charge that may have something to do with these perceptions as well.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left. Scott Althaus, our guest, he's associate professor in the Department of Speech Communication and Political Science here at University of Illinois. We had several people and probably can't get everybody, but we'll try. We'll see what we can do. Next caller in line is Urbana, and that's line 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi. You know, in the 1960s, a lot of the, you know, the U.S. Public was the World War II generation who had grown up in the hard times of the 1930s depression and had fought, you know, the World War II greatest war of all time. And they had in memory, the success in that and the success of Korea. And I can imagine that, you know, when we were in Vietnam, they figured, well, we've had two successful wars, and this is a relatively small war, and they were accustomed to that kind of thing, and so they might have been more, you know, inclined to accept it. And then now in these Iraq wars we've had, we have the exact opposite. We have, you know, a lot of the public now is these, you know, the flower children baby boomers who grew up in the 60s and also kids who grew up in with the, you know, the rock and roll of the 70s and 80s and who don't have any experience with war, except that we do have a very negative memory of Vietnam. So as far as the media, you could argue that just the people themselves, the population, has different inclinations now than we had in the past.
The caller is certainly correct, and the World War II generation has carried through a series of particular kinds of attitudes all the way through their life cycle, as the Vietnam generation has done as well. And that's why so many social scientists are very curious to see what young people are doing today, because the formative events of our youngest generation coming of age politically maybe begins with the impeachment of President Clinton in 1998 and then this strange 2000 presidential election where we didn't know the results for a long, long time, and now 9/11 and the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so, however, young people end up breaking. By the way, there is not a clear sense in the opinion surveys being done right now whether younger people are more likely to lean Republican or Democratic, or whether they are more in support or against the war in Iraq than their elders. But when all the dust settles, we're going to have a new generation that's going to carry its own set of values into the future on this.
I'll just ask one question and hang up.
Sure.
I was wondering. I get almost all my news from WILL and NPR, and I was wondering if there's any newspaper. I used to read newspapers, but I was wondering if there's any newspaper that you would recommend that you consider to be not, you know, kind of beholden to corporate interests and maybe having a higher quality and more impartial news. And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I think there are a variety of high-quality news sources in this country and around the world, but I would have a hard time choosing one of them as being the one source that people should go to. And my recommendation to the students I teach in my classes on politics and the media are to seek out a variety of news sources that represent a variety of different points of view, some from domestic, some from international. To give you some international examples that may not be too familiar to you, The Guardian in the United Kingdom is a left-leaning newspaper that is widely prided for its coverage of international politics. The International Herald Tribune is another good international paper. If you want to get news from the region of Afghanistan, there's a Pakistani paper, The Dawn, www.dawn.com, that you can, it's sort of the Pakistani equivalent of the New York Times. And it's amazing today that we can have the internet at our fingertips to be able to go out and find this wide range of news. But I would encourage people to, if they're interested in finding out what other sources are saying, to really reach broadly. And there is one website that I could recommend if you want to find the broadest range of news, and that is totalnews.com. If you go to totalnews.com, you can pick newspapers and television and websites by region of the country and if they are English language or not, and you can get a real good sense of what your options are for coverage of local stories all around the country and the world.
Okay. Let's go to Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I'm not sure if you're going to have enough time to talk about this, but you haven't talked about the spin that it's not limited to politics. I no longer listen to television news, and I don't read most newspapers because I've found that every single time there's a major story, long before they've gone through the who, what, where, and how, they've already decided what the spin is. And you can almost see it. It's like the talking points they talk about in the Republican Party. It seems like all of the reporters, I don't know whether it's laziness or what, they jump on, this is the way we're going to show it, and this is the way it's always explained. And that's one problem for me, that there's always a spin, and I still don't know the details before I'm getting a spin. And the second thing that happened, which is why I don't watch television news anymore, is that I found out that their editorial comment does not have to match the visuals. In other words, if they're giving a report about a riot in Cambodia or in the Cameroon, they may show people rioting, but it doesn't mean that it's the one that they're talking about. It could be from 2-3 days ago, a month ago. It's whatever. And I think that I always assumed that what I was seeing was what they were talking about. And when I found out that that's not true, and I found out that happened by accident because one news station happened to repeat the same visuals for two different stories, I became very disenchanted. So I think there are problems with the quality of the news we're receiving, which might be why a lot of people simply reject it.
Well, it's certainly the case that we have a different style of news coverage today, particularly on television, than we did 30 or 40 years ago. There was a time when news stories were constructed around what's the most important facts. You know, lay those out first. It's in the business, it's known as the inverted pyramid style. You lay those out first, and then the rest of the story kind of picks up on the context. Today, the more common type of reporting that we see both on television and in newspapers is a story-driven mode of reporting. I call it the narrative style of reporting, where first we hear what's the storyline, and then facts are brought in to illustrate that. And that can have important consequences for the kind of coverage we get, for instance, about the campaign, because it's an easy story to say that Bush and Kerry are disagreeing about a particular issue and to delve into the reasons why they're picking this issue as a strategic point to disagree on. It is a different story to say Bush and Kerry have important differences on an issue. Let's explore those differences in depth and detail. And we tend to see, I think, the former more than the latter because it's an easier form of reporting. It's an easier story for people to pick up. And at least the marketing people in many of these news organizations feel that's the kind of news that people want to watch.
Just do you think that it is true? Because one of the criticisms that has been made, I think, now for some years of the way the news media cover political campaigns is too much attention to strategy. And the horse, what is often called the horse race aspect, that is, who's ahead, who's behind, and what are they doing about that? And not enough attention paid to issues and what it is that the candidates are saying about those things and what they, you know, what person A would do if he was elected, what person B would do if he was elected.
Well, this is a common complaint about news coverage of the campaigns right now. But I think if we look at the whole picture, if we start at the beginning of the primary campaign all the way up until now and to Election Day, and we look at the amount of issue coverage that's out there, we would find there's a lot. But unfortunately, it happens when many people are not paying close attention to the news. The early part of the campaign, the pre-primary period, we've got lots of stories about what the candidates would do and what their policy proposals are. But the news focuses on what is new. And once those issue positions are laid out, unless there is a change in the campaign's issue platform, we're going to hear less and less about those things because at least to reporters who've been covering these campaigns, they're familiar topics. They haven't changed very much. And what is the latest thing? Well, it's the attack between Bush and Kerry, or it's somebody falls off a campaign platform and that becomes an issue. And we've got basically a fixed amount of hard issue coverage that's stretched out over about a year and a half. And many people who see this set of tendencies suggest that if we had shorter campaigns, we'd have campaigns that feature a lot more issue coverage. And that may be true. But the good news is that we have the internet, and we have a lot of third-party sources out there like Project VoteSmart that can give us the issue positions, and we can go back in time in a way of going to the library except electronically and find out what the news was covering back then. So the internet opens up a new range of possibilities for us to get more information about the positions, as we're not as dependent today on just what the latest news is coming out on the front page of the New York Times.
Got to leave it there. Thank you very much for
You're
being with
welcome.
Us. I appreciate it. Scott Altos, he's Associate Professor of Speech Communication and Political Science at University of Illinois. The broadcast today made possible with support from World Harvest International Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, for over 14 years providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions, requests, always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Also, support comes from Sanguine Auditorium, UIS Springfield, presenting The Invisible Man, Saturday, October 31st, 7 p.m. This classical production presented by the Aquila Theater Company, one of the foremost producers of touring classical theater. Ticket information available, 800-207-6960. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll take a look at American history through the eyes of our